Robert Vinoy, Foundations of Biblical Prophecy, Lecture Number 12. We are looking at the arguments for the late date of Daniel. We've looked at the assumption that predictive prophecy doesn't happen. We've looked at the historical errors and now see, quote, there are alleged late linguistic features, end quote. This argument centers over the use of several Greek loanwords found in Daniel chapter 3, verse 5, for musical instruments, as well as the use of Aramaic that is said to be of a late type of Aramaic. As you are aware, Daniel 2, 4, through the end of chapter 7, is written in Aramaic rather than Hebrew. The Aramaic of that section is said to be of a late form of Aramaic. Again, I don't think either of those arguments is convincing. There's an abundance of evidence of contacts between the Greeks and the ancient Near East prior to the time of Alexander the Great. The assumption is that if you have Greek loanwords, it would have to be after the time of the development of the Greek Empire under Alexander and the spread of the Greek language in connection with his conquest. The argument can really be turned around. It is surprising there are not more Greek words than there are if the book were actually written in the 2nd century BC. There are only three, and these are technical kinds of words for musical instruments, so it doesn't appear to be something fairly significant. Those who study the Aramaic question will find this gets rather technical and complex. An article stated that 90% of the vocabulary in the Aramaic vocabulary of Daniel is attested from documents from the 5th century BC or earlier. If you look at page 16 of your citations, there's some material there at the bottom of the page and over onto page 17 from Joyce Baldwin's Daniel commentary in the Tyndale series. You'll notice she is speaking about the Aramaic argument and says, quote, the Aramaic of Daniel is shown to be imperial Aramaic, or, in itself, practically undateable with any conviction within circa 600 to 330 BC. It is, therefore, irrelevant to make distinctions between, quote, Eastern, end quote, and, quote, Western, end quote, Aramaic, which developed later. The only indication of a place of origin arises out of the word order, which betrays Akkadian influence, and proves, quote, that the Aramaic of Daniel belongs to the early tradition of imperial Aramaic, as opposed to later local Palestinian derivatives of imperial Aramaic, end quote. If you look at your bibliography on page 8, you'll notice there is an essay by K.A. Kitchen, quote, the Aramaic of Daniel, end quote. And then there are three articles by Edwin Yamauchi, quote, the archaeological background of Daniel, end quote. Quote, Daniel and contacts between the Aegean and the Near East before Alexander, end quote. And, quote, the Greek words in Daniel in light of Greek influence in the Near East, end quote. Those articles are particularly useful on this question of what kind of Aramaic we have, as well as these Greek loanwords. I think that both Baldwin's and Yamauchi's conclusions that these are not strong arguments are very well argued. I won't take the time to read further from Baldwin in your citations. But let's go to the handout. We read there that the evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls attests to the existence of Daniel in copies in Qumran in 150 to 100 BC. At the latest, or perhaps even earlier. There is a strong argument for dating them both prior to 165 BC. There is not sufficient time to copy the composition, and it having achieved canonical status with the Qumran community if the late date for his composition is accepted. In other words, if we're going to say it was written about 165, well, by 150 at least, it's already recognized in the Qumran community as a canonical part of Scripture. It seems like that is very improbable if it had only been recently written. Conclusion. There are no compelling reasons for dating Daniel late. There are adequate answers to each of the historical and linguistic arguments for the late date. The underlying question is whether or not one is prepared to accept the possibility of general predictive prophecy. If one is convinced that Daniel could not have spoken so clearly about the future, especially the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, then one must seek to date it subsequent to this time. For those who accept the possibility of genuine predictions, this material, along with many other predictive sections of Scripture, are used as evidence that there is a God who controls all of history, who has spoken to his people about future events through his servants, the prophets. Student question. Why did Daniel write in both Hebrew and Aramaic? I don't think that anybody has ever clearly answered that. Some try to argue that the part in Hebrew is directed more to the Jewish people, and the other section to the world at large. Aramaic was more universally understood, but I'm not exactly sure you can explain that. I can't give you more than that. I don't think anyone ever has given a good sound explanation for that. Section C. As far as our general topic is concerned, quote, were the prophets writers, end quote, is, quote, the history of traditions school. That is something that has developed in the last half century. One of the early promoters of the view was a man named H.S. Nyberg from Uppsala in Sweden. He wrote a book, Studies of Hosea. According to Nyberg, the normal manner of transmission of various types of information in the ancient Near East was oral rather than written. So this history of traditions attempted to argue that the means and manner of transmission of these bodies of material that he found in the Old Testament recorded by the prophets was an oral means of transmission rather than written. He said that stories, songs, legends, and myths were passed down from generation to generation by word of mouth, rather than as written literature. He claimed that this is true of the Old Testament, so that pre-exilic Palestinian writing was limited to practical matters, such as contracts, monuments, official lists, letters, those things that were more technical things. But transmission of history, epic tales, folk legends, etc., were done orally. Nyberg then proposes that if that's the case, then the conclusion is that the written Old Testament comes along much later. It was the creation of the Jewish community between the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BC and the Maccabean period, about 165 BC. So in that period, when Israel went to Babylon, until the 2nd century BC was the period when all this oral material was put into written form. What is in written form prior to that time must be considered very slight. Transmission was almost entirely oral. Thirdly, the prophetic preaching was also transmitted orally and was only written down after the Babylonian captivity. The prophets were not writers. See, that's the question we started this discussion with. Were the prophets writers? He said, no, they were preachers. The concepts that they proclaimed were best done orally until after the exile. There's a quotation there from Nyberg found in an article by Eisfeld in The Old Testament in Modern Study. It's in your bibliography where Nyberg says, quote, the written Old Testament is a creation of the Jewish community after the exile. What preceded it was certainly only in small measure in fixed written form. Only with the greatest reserve can we reckon with the writers among the prophets. We must reckon with circles, sometimes centers, of tradition that preserved and handed down material. It is self-evident that such a process of transmission could not continue without some change in the material handed on. But we have not textual corruptions, but an active transformation. For the rest, Old Testament scholarship would do well to consider earnestly what possibility it can ever have of regaining the ipsa verba, the very words of Old Testament personalities. We have nothing but the tradition of their sayings, and it is in the highest degree unlikely that any but the written form of transmission ever existed for them." End quote. It pulls you into thinking out of the categories of written literature into the categories of an oral transferal of tradition down through the circles of disciples from generation to generation, in which process the material is transformed. You can't really get back to the very words of the prophets because of the nature in which this material was handed down. Number 2, Harris Birkeland was a student of Nyberg, and he took his views and applied them to individual prophetic books. He said the prophetic books were most likely the literary representation of an already petrified oral tradition. The prophet was surrounded by a circle, small at first, but then ever growing, which continued his work after his death. It's among these circles of disciples that the living transmission of prophetic utterance found their home. Birkeland conjectured that the prophets were kept alive or combined into ever-growing, larger, quote, traditional complexes, end quote, combinations of prophetic renouncements and tradition complexes. Besides the words of the prophets, other information about them was fused together. Thus, through the generations, the prophetic sayings were handed down and in the process were constantly remolded. What was finally retained depended on what proved itself to be relevant and active in the life of the people, so that in the process there was a choice made, which Birkeland compared to the survival of the fittest in natural life. What proved itself significant and relevant was preserved. The whole transmission process took place in the so-called, quote, tradition circles, end quote. Because of the means of transmission, one can no longer say what originally belonged to the prophet and what should be ascribed to the tradition. So he says, in most cases, we must give up the attempt, quote, to get back to the prophets and the great genius himself, end quote. Where are the very words of the prophet? Well, this whole idea about the method of transmission tells us you can't really know exactly. In consequence, we must banish from our study of the prophetic books such ideas as, quote, notes, end quotes, quote, larger literary pieces, end quote, expressions which have been shaped according to literary patterns. We must rather substitute for these such expressions as are suitable for the oral process of transmission, such as, quote, tradition, end quote, quote, complex, end quote, quote, circles, end quote, etc. Further, we must fully recognize the fact that, quote, questions about the ipsima verba of the prophets can only be solved, if at all, not on literary critical, but on traditio historical grounds, end quote. In other words, you move out of literary kinds of concerns into concerns of oral tradition. The third important thing here in this approach is Eduard Nielsen, his volume, Oral Tradition, and the Modern Problem of Old Testament Introduction, which was published in English, and he goes along the same lines as Nyberg and Birkeland. I want to give a, quote, a synopsis of this thesis, end quote. Pull your attention to some of the material that he brings out in his book, not so much for the argument that he's making, although that is certainly important, but just for the evidence he gives of the role that memorization of enormous amounts of material that was handed down orally played in ancient Near Eastern culture. Some of this is interesting. On your handout, quote, the first chapter of this book deals with the use of oral tradition in the ancient Near East. Nielsen shows that the modern contempt for learning by heart is not characteristic of the ancient Semites. I think that contempt is still significant for the 21st century America. We don't like memorizing things. He calls attention to some Babylonian texts that indicated that memorization of old texts that form the basis of oral traditions was not strange in Babylon. Look at your citation on page 17. Section A, quote, "The modern contempt for learning texts by heart is the necessary basis for oral tradition. The ancient Mesopotamian culture seems to have been enthusiastic about writing, but we have some contexts that stress the importance attached to learning by heart. From the often quoted conclusion of the Ira myth, we cite, quote, "The scribe who learns this text by heart escapes the enemy, is honored. The congregation of the learned, where my name is constantly spoken, I will open his ears," end quote. In Ashurbanipal's prayer to Shamash, notable because it concludes with a curse and a benediction, somewhat similar to ancient Oriental royal inscription, in which we read in the benediction, quote, "Whosoever shall learn this text by heart and glorify the judge of the gods, Shamash, may he make his precious, may his words of his mouth please the people," end quote. This is a reference to learning these texts, committing them to memory. Back to the handout. In Arabia, the Quran, especially in the earlier time of existence, was transmitted orally. Anyone who desired to be admitted to the mosque of Al-Azhar in Cairo must be able to recite the whole Quran without hesitation. That mosque is still a very important mosque in Cairo. Look at paragraph B on page 18 of your citation. Quote, "Turning to West Semitic culture, we will remark that it is quite apparent that the written word is not highly valued. It is considered an independent mode of expression. Even if the Quran has given rise to a, quote, theology of scripture, end quote, which may well be compared with that of Judaism and Protestantism, the written copies of the Quran play an astonishingly unobtrusive role in Islam. The Quran has constantly, as in the first days of its existence, has been handed down orally. Everyone wants to be admitted to the mosque of Al-Azhar in Cairo must be able to recite the whole Quran without hesitation, and their holy writ is learned by heart by one of the initiated reciting it, and the younger disciples repeating it until they know it by heart," end quote. Now that is a different world than we live in. To commit to memory the whole book of the Quran by hearing it orally, cite it, and then committing it to your memory so that you can recite it as a group of initiates to a mosque. Back to your outline. In Judaism, Johanan ben Zakkai, a prisoner in the camp of Vespasian, could recite the entire Mishnah from memory and thereby know exactly what time of day it was because he knew exactly how long it would take to recite each part of the Mishnah. Go to paragraph C at the bottom of page 18 of your citations. The story tells of Johanan ben Zakkai in the camp of Vespasian. After he had received an audience by Vespasian for the first time, quote, "they seized him and locked him up with seven locks and asked him what time it was at night. And he told them, and what time it was during the day, and he told them. And how did our master, Johanan ben Zakkai, know? From the recitation of the Mishnah." In other words, Rabbi Johanan ben Zakkai not only knew his Mishnah by heart, but he knew just how long it took to recite each paragraph and how much time he needed to get through it all. End quote. So somebody asked him what time it was, and he'd know because of his recitation of the Mishnah. Now, that's probably a little over-exaggerated, but you see here what Nielsen is establishing, is that in the ancient Near East, people committed enormous amounts of material to their memories. Paragraph D at the top of page 19, which is from Nielsen again, quote, "as an explicit reaction against the spread of the art of writing, we may cite the following words of Plato from the Phaedrias. They are remarkable as the reaction which does not originate with the common people, the ignorant crude masses, as an illiterate people are not characterized by contempt, but by respect for the written word. These words represent rather an attitude Plato had in common with the intellectual aristocracy of his day, end quote. And here, Plato quotes Socrates. Plato was a pupil of Socrates. Quote, Socrates, I heard then that at Naucratis in Egypt was one of that ancient gods of the country, the one whose sacred bird is called Ibis, and the name of the god himself was Thuth. He it was who invented numbers and arithmetic, and geometry and astronomy, and also draughts and dice, and most important of all, letters. Now the king of all Egypt at that time was Thaumas, who lived in the great city in the upper region, which the Greeks call the Egyptian Thebes, and they call the god himself Amon. To him came Thuth to show his inventions, saying they ought to be imported to other Egyptians. But Thaumas asks what use there was in each, and as Thuth enumerated their uses, expressed praise or blame according as he approved or disapproved, the story goes that Thaumas said many things to Thuth in praise or blame of the various arts, which would take too long to repeat. But when they came to letters, quote, This invention, O king, said Thuth, will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memories, for it is in the elixir of memory and wisdom that I have discovered, end quote. But Thaumas replied, quote, Most ingenious Thuth, one has the ability to beget arts, but the ability to judge their usefulness or harmfulness to their users belongs to another. And now you, who are the father of letters, have been led by your affection to ascribe to them a power the opposite of that which they really possess, for this invention will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, because they will not practice their memory. Their trust in writing, produced by external characters which are not part of themselves, will discourage the use of their memory within. You have invented an elixir, not of memory, but of reminding, and you offer your pupils the appearance of wisdom, but not true wisdom, end quote. Why? Quote, For they will read many things without instruction, and will, therefore, seem to know many things, when they are for the most part ignorant and hard to get along with, since they are not wise, but only appear wise, end quote. I find that quite interesting, if that point is made by Socrates many, many centuries ago. And then you come up to our technological age, where we not only have the printed word, but now there's all this information that we are drowned in, and we look at this stuff all the time, and 90% of it we forget right away because we haven't internalized it. It's just kind of floating out there. We may have lost a lot by turning away from committing things to memory, particularly in the realm of Scripture, and the words of Scripture, and the things of that sort. So I find this fascinating, not so much because it really supports the argument that Nielsen is trying to make with it, but just because of the issues and questions that it raises. Back to page 16 of the handout. Thousands of Brahmins still learn their books by heart, and it is 153,826 words long. Hindus transmitted their Vedas from generation to generation orally. The same was true in ancient Greece. Back on page 19 of the citation, there's a paragraph on that. We won't take time to look at that, but Nielsen cites all these examples, and then what he says is that in Israel, religious texts were transmitted in the same fashion. And only after the exile did they find great fixation. And he agrees with Nyberg that the introduction of writing was due to a crisis of confidence, and that crisis of confidence was caused by going into exile. They were going to lose stuff, so they needed to write it down. He attempts to establish this connection in a twofold manner. One, negatively, by establishing this subordinate role of writing in Israel, and then second, positively, by establishing the significance of oral transmission. I wanted to take time to go through his argument of that discussion, but according to him, prior to the exile of Israel, writing was primarily only for practical purposes, such as contracts, governments, monuments, official registers, lists, letters, and not used for purely literary purposes. The tradition of history, epic tales, folk legends, even laws were to him handed down orally. In his conclusion, he says, quote, writers should not be reckoned among the prophets and poets, except with greatest caution, end quote. That's the tradition's history approach. B, quote, assessment of Nielsen's thesis, end quote. It's certainly true that oral tradition existed in ancient Israel, but we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a Dutch scholar, W. H. Gispen, who wrote a monograph on oral tradition in the Old Testament. In that monograph, he discusses 28 different texts in the Old Testament that speak of oral tradition. Outstanding among them are Exodus 10, verses 1 and 2, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 20 through 25, Judges 6:13, Psalm 44, verses 1 through 3, and Psalm 78. Let's look at a couple of these. Exodus chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. That's in the context of the plagues, and you read there, quote, the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials, so that I may perform these miraculous signs of mine among them, end quote. And then in verse 2, quote, that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, that they may know that I am the Lord, end quote. Part of the Lord's purpose here was that the parents would tell these things to their children orally, and their children would pass it down to their children, and that story of what God did would be transmitted through the generations. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 20 to 25, quote, in the future, when your son asks you, what is the meaning of the stipulations, decrees, and laws the Lord our God has commanded you, tell him, and here's the story of what God has done for his people, quote, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Before our eyes, the Lord sent miraculous signs and wonders, great and terrible, upon Egypt and Pharaoh and his whole household. But he brought us out from there to bring us in and give us the land that he promised on oath to our forefathers. The Lord commanded us to obey all these decrees and to fear the Lord our God, so that we might always prosper and be alive, as is the case today. And if we are careful to obey all this law before the Lord our God, as he has commanded us, that will be our righteousness. So tell that to your children when they ask, what do these things mean? End quote. Let's go to Psalm 44, verses 1 through 3. Quote, we have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what you did in their days, in the days long ago. With your hand you drove out the nations and planted our fathers. You crushed the peoples and made our fathers flourish. It was not by their sword that they won the land, nor did their arm bring them victory. It was your right hand, your arm, and the light of your face, for you loved them. End quote. Then Psalm 78, let's start at verse 1. Quote, O my people, hear my teaching, listen to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter hidden things, things from of old. What we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power, and the wonders he has done, end quote, and so on. Verse 6, quote, so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God, and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commands, end quote. So there are clear references to an oral tradition functioning in the Old Testament period. But what we should notice is, 1, this oral transmission is found in a Sitzenleben in the family circle. What is its situation in life? It's the fathers telling the children telling their children. The persons who passed on their tradition were fathers to their children. There is no evidence of professional bards or troubadours such as existed in other lines and places. 2, it has its purpose in the words of Psalm 78:6, that the generation to come might know the works of God. 3, the tradition passed on consisted, at least from what we can tell, from references and summarizations of the basic facts of redemptive history, a brief resume, you might say, of what God had done for his people. 4, which I think quite important, that tradition was never isolated from the written fixation. In Exodus chapter 17, 14, for example, we're back to the Mosaic here. This is where Israel is attacked by the Amalekites on the way from Egypt to Sinai. Then the Lord says to Moses, quote, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven, end quote. Sure, that could be told with children, but it was also written down so that the tradition was not isolated from a written fixation. This was also the case outside of Israel for the most part, even in those countries Nielsen mentioned, Egypt and Babylon, and also with the Quran. You see, the examples that Nielsen uses really don't establish his point, because those legends learned in ancient Mesopotamia were texts that were memorized. The Quran was a text that was memorized and passed on. So, yes, there was oral tradition, but the oral tradition doesn't operate outside or apart from a written fixation of the text, even in his examples. The oral recitation follows the written original. 5. I don't think it can be denied that Israel had written laws at an early time. He tries to argue that even the laws were passed down orally. There are numerous law codes in written form that have been uncovered in the Middle East that long predate the time of Moses. For example, the Hammurabi Code and the Lipit-Ishtar Code. They are all in an earlier time than Moses and all in written form on clay tablets. And finally, there's also explicit mention of written history. In Numbers 33, verse 2, speaks of the record Moses kept of the journey from place to place. Numbers 21, 14 speaks of the book of the laws of the Lord, called a book or a scroll. It must have been a written source. Yet Nielsen maintains it existed only in oral form as a poetic composition until the time of the fall of Samaria. In 1 Kings 11:41, the book where the history of Solomon is mentioned, 1 Kings 14:19 and 29 mentions the book that chronicles the kings of Judah. Further, there is mention of the writing prophets. Our concern here is primarily who the prophets were. Were the prophets writers? Look at 1 Chronicles 29:29. Quote, as for the events of King David's reign, from beginning to end, they are written in the records of Samuel the seer, the records of Nathan the prophet, and the records of Gad the seer, together with the details of his reign and power and the circumstances that surrounded him in Israel and the kingdoms of all the other lands, end quote. It sounds pretty comprehensive. It says these were written by these prophets, Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. And then in 2 Chronicles 12, verse 15, quote, as for the events of Rehoboam's reign, from beginning to end, are they not written in the records of Shemaiah the prophet and Iddo the seer that deal with genealogies? End quote. And then there are three more references there to Iddo the seer. Interestingly enough, 2 Chronicles 32:32 refers to Isaiah. Let's look at that one. Quote, The other events of Hezekiah's reign and his acts of devotion are written in the vision of the prophet of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, in the books of the kings of Judah and Israel, end quote. So it seems to me that even though it's an interesting idea, and even though Nielsen appeals to a lot of these examples of enormous amounts of material committed to memory that was transmitted in oral form, it doesn't make the case that the oral tradition existed apart from a written fixation. So I don't think he established his point. I might just insert here that there are some places the evidence of an oral tradition in ancient Israel supplements the written material of the Old Testament. And what I mean by that is if you look at Psalm 77, it talks about the deliverance of Israel from Egypt. Go to verse 15. Quote, "With your mighty arm you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O Lord, the waters saw you and writhed. The very depths were convulsed. The clouds poured down water. The skies resounded with thunder. Your arrows flashed back and forth. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and quaked. Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters. Though your footprints were not seen, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron," end quote. In that reference to the Red Sea, it mentions here, quote, "thunder and lightning," end quote. If you go back through the text in Exodus 14, there's no reference to thunder and lightning or storm events. Where did that come from? It may have come out of the oral tradition from the psalmist being aware that it is using it in his description of what happened at that time. In Joshua 24:2, there is a covenant renewal ceremony at the end of Joshua's life that he held at Shechem. And Joshua says in chapter 24, verse 2, quote, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago, your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods," end quote. Where's Joshua get that? There's no reference to Terah and Nahor worshipping other gods in Genesis. There may well have been oral information that came down through the generations. In 2 Samuel 3, verse 8, you have a reference to the magicians at the time of the Exodus in Egypt, Jannes and Jambres. Where do those names come from? There is no reference in the book of Exodus to the names of the magicians. It may have come down through oral tradition. There are a lot of examples of that kind of information in the latter points of the Old Testament that were in the New Testament included. That's not in earlier written material of the canonical books of the Old Testament. So I don't think we need to be defensive about a role that oral tradition may have played in ancient Israel. It may have been a very prominent thing. But the point is that it didn't function in the way Nielsen is trying to say that it did, that it was the means of transmission of these great bodies of prophetic material down through centuries of time until ultimately it came to a written fixation. So in conclusion, 1, even though oral tradition existed in ancient Israel, it did not play the role that Nielsen ascribes to it. And 2, I don't think there's any convincing evidence that writing was not used for literary purposes prior to the exile. That's contrary to all we know about ancient areas of the world, as well as the Old Testament. Recent extra-biblical archaeological findings at Ebla, for example, established the use of writing for, quote, "literary purposes," end quote, in the time prior to Abraham. You're going way back to 2300 BC in Ebla, and according to what is said about those texts, even though the texts themselves haven't been published, there's a lot of epic kind of story material there. And 3, the sources referred to by the chronicler indicate the prophets did write. The chronicler specifically names a number of prophets who wrote. Now, Isaiah was the only one mentioned who was one of the writers of the canonical prophets. The others' material wasn't preserved, but they were prophets who wrote. there is no reason to conclude that the prophets were not writers. One should not overlook the detailed description of the writing process of the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 36. That brings us to Roman numeral number 9. Quote, some hermeneutical principles for the interpretation of prophetic writings, end quote. And A, quote, some general characteristics of predictive prophecy, end quote. I want to look at those general characteristics first, and then under B, quote, some guidelines for interpretation, end quote. So first, some general characteristics of predictive prophecy. 1, quote, the purpose of predictive prophecy, end quote. We've already referred to two aspects, you might say, of biblical prophecy that sometimes have been labeled with the terms, quote, forthtelling, end quote, and, quote, foretelling, end quote. By forthtelling, I mean exhortation, reproof, correction, and instruction. By foretelling, I mean prediction of things to come to pass in the future, some in the more immediate future, and some in the distant future. I think that quite commonly the forthtelling aspect of a prophetic message is neglected in favor of the foretelling aspect in a way that often obscures the fundamental purpose of the prophetic message. We are going to talk here about the purpose of predictive prophecy. What is it? I think its purpose is not to cater to the appetite of people who are curious about the future, and predictive prophecy should not be used in that way today. The predictive element in prophecy, which is what most people think of when you talk about the prophets, should never be separated or isolated from its parenetic function, that is, from its instructional nature. The prophetic message is meant to exhort, to reprove, to reflect, to encourage, and to call to repentance. Look at your citations, page 20. There are, I think, three different writers here. First is from William Dryness, and notice what he said, quote, it is no coincidence that the publication of Hal Lindsey's first book on prophecy, The Late Great Planet Earth, an enormously popular book 25 years ago, coincided with the greatest revival of astrology in 300 years. It is interesting to note how often his book appears in bookstores alongside astrological manuals. Man can escape as easily into prophecy as into astrology. In either case, he is a pawn and thus relieved of moral responsibility. That this was no part of Lindsey's purposes from the final page of the book. But we must be careful that our longing for Christ's return is not motivated by our desire to escape responsibility, end quote. And then Ross in the next paragraph, quote, if the prophecies are indeed being motivated by a basic ethical concern, as I am convinced a detailed study will demonstrate, then it is our response that is the most critical issue. We should become experts in prophetic interpretation. If we have all knowledge of things future, yes, even if we know the day and hour of Jesus' coming, but if our lives are not transformed by the expectation of what God will do, then we've turned prophetic study into a parlor game and our knowledge becomes a curse rather than a blessing, end quote. Then lastly, Dwight Wilson now puts here something that has often been, I think, a weak feature about premillennial eschatological thought. I would identify myself as premillennial, but there has been a lot of abuses of prophetic interpretation for premillennialists. He says, quote, the premillenarians' history is strewn with a mass of enormous speculations which have undermined their credibility. Sometimes false indications have been made dogmatically, and at other times only as probabilities or possibilities. But the result has always been the same, the increased skepticism toward premillenarianism. The persons confronted with a premillenarian's presentation need to be conscious of the composite past of prophetic interpretation, which has included in the following phenomena. The current crisis is usually identified as a sign of the end, whether it was the Russo-Japanese War, the First World War, the Second World War, the Palestine War, the Suez Crisis, the June War, and the Yom Kippur War. The revival of the Roman Empire has been identified variously as Mussolini's Empire, the League of Nations, the United Nations, the European Defense Community, the Common Market, and NATO. Speculation on the Antichrist included Napoleon, Mussolini, Hitler, and Henry Kissinger, end quote. There's a history of that kind of identification with the fulfillment of certain prophetic sections in the Old Testament of the current events that have proven themselves erroneous time after time. Some people get caught up in that kind of thing, kind of lost and fascinated by it. Let's turn to the Bible itself as far as the function of predictive prophecy. What is its purpose? Look at 1 John chapter 3, verse 3. After speaking about the second coming of Christ in verse 2, quote, "We know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure," end quote. In other words, the second coming of Christ is not something just for speculation. It will affect the way you live now. Look at 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 7 as well. Quote, "The end of all things is near. Therefore be clear-minded and self-controlled, so that you may pray because Christ is going to return," end quote. That's to affect the way we live now. Quote, "Above all, love each other deeply because love covers a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Each one should use whatever gift he has to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, he shall speak as he is saying the very words of God. If one serves, you should do it with strength," end quote. Why? Quote, "Because the end of all things is near. It's coming," end quote. Look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 11. In verse 10, he spoke about the heavens disappearing, destroyed by fire, earth, and everything in it lay bare. Quote, "Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You all ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God," end quote. Look at verse 14, quote, "So then, dear friends, since you are looking forward to this, make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him," end quote. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, quote, "Now, dear brothers, about times and dates, we do not need to write to you, for you know very well that the Lord will come like a thief in the night," end quote. And he goes on in verse 6 about our response, end quote. Quote, "So then, let us not be like others who are asleep, but let us be alert, self-controlled," end quote. Down to verse 8, quote, "Let us be self-controlled, putting on faith and love, putting on faith and love as a breastplate, and the hope of salvation as a helmet," end quote. Verse 11, quote, "Encourage one another and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing," end quote. We look at a text like that, where the predictive element in prophecy is given to God's people to show them that his program of redemption is moving forward according to his divine purpose, plan, and schedule. History of all peoples and nations are subject to this sovereign ordering of the historical process as it moves forward through his purposes. The fact is intended to affect the manner of life of those who hear that message. The prophets spoke to induce holy living and obedience to God among God's people in their time, as well as in the time of those who live long after the time in which they preached. We should not lose sight of that, because that, to me, is the most important part of the reason for the initial delivery of the message. Yes, God does have a purpose and a plan. There are these things that are going to happen in times in the future to us, but that should shape the way in which we live now. So that forthtelling aspect of the prophetic message shouldn't be swallowed up by interest in the foretelling aspect of the prophetic message. Okay, we'll have to stop there. End of Dr. Robert Vannoy's Foundations of Biblical Prophecy, Lecture Number 12.